Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. My name is Carsten Schell. I'm a member of the board of the FCC. Before we get into today's topic, Islam in Hong Kong, I just want to make a couple of announcements of upcoming events. And I'd like to ask everybody, if you haven't done so, please turn your mobile phone on silent so it doesn't interrupt the later presentation. As always, we have a whole nice lineup of coming events at the club. So tomorrow night, I'm going to present a film on Agent Orange with the producer of that film, Masako Sakata, being present for the showing. That's tomorrow for dinner at 7:15 here in the main dining room. On Thursday, we're going to have a talk on the Arab Spring. Where do we go from here? So we get an interesting overview of the developments of the last bit over a year in the Middle East by Vali Nasser of Johns Hopkins University. Next week, we're going to learn more about early meteorology in colonial Hong Kong, Typhoons and Taskmasters by Kevin McCohen of Hong Kong University. That's a luncheon on the coming Monday. Very interesting talk on Tuesday for lunch is the world and Chinese diplomacy in 2013. From the Vice President and Senior Fellow of the Chinese China Institute of International Studies, Dr. Ruan Zhongzhe, who's also been in the Chinese diplomatic service in Washington, D.C. until 2011. So he's going to have some firsthand interesting experience of what China is doing in global diplomacy. And the last event I'm going to announce for next week is going quietly cuckoo on a Chinese mountain, the experience of a Westerner in China, the rise and fall and rise again of an entrepreneur in China. Mark Kitto is going to give that talk on the next Wednesday for lunchtime. So it's my great pleasure to introduce Paul O'Connor, who has written his doctoral thesis on a very, very interesting topic related to life and culture in Hong Kong, and that is Islam in Hong Kong. I mean, for me, it was really, I was fortunate enough to do a bit of work in the Middle East in the last 4 years, and it was the first time that I got exposed to Islam and to daily life in an Islamic society, and learning of Paul's book and his research gave me a very interesting overview of something I don't know anything about, even though I've lived here 21 years, but Islam in Hong Kong was just nothing I ever experienced besides seeing the mosque on my way through Tsim Sha Tsui and seeing lots of veiled ladies on a Sunday around Victoria Park. But I don't want to keep you any longer, and I'd like to introduce Paul O'Connor. Please, Paul.
Thank you, Carsten, for that introduction. Okay, good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for coming. There are over 220,000 Muslims living and working in Hong Kong. And collectively, they account for about 3% of our population. Just to give some context to that statistic, if we imagine Islam in the West, if we think about the UK, in England and Wales, Muslims account for 3% in that environment. In the United States, Muslims account for 1% to 2% of the population. In Australia, Muslims account for about 2.5% of the population. So in Hong Kong, we have Muslims at 3%. And the largest community of Muslims are Indonesian at the current moment, and they account for just over 152,000 people. And in the majority of cases, they are foreign domestic workers. And again, because of that, they are also nominally a female community. So the largest community of Muslims in Hong Kong at the present moment are female Indonesian foreign domestic workers. But in addition to that, there are some longer standing communities in Hong Kong. We have a Chinese community, a Chinese Muslims, or Wei Muslims, who have been here for a long time, and they account for about 30,000 people at the present moment. And we also have a number of South Asian Muslims, Pakistanis, for example, number about 20,000 in Hong Kong, just under. In addition to that, in recent years, we've had increasingly numbers of African Muslims come to Hong Kong as traders and businessmen. We also have some asylum seekers who are also contributing to the Muslim community. And we have much smaller numbers of Muslims from all over the world. We have Turkish people, we have people from Lebanon, we have people throughout the Middle East. So Hong Kong has a real diverse array of Muslims in the territory. So those are the basic facts about statistics and numbers. But we also have five major mosques in Hong Kong which actually attend to the needs of this Muslim community. Four of these mosques are on Hong Kong Island. They include the Wan Chai Mosque, the Shelley Street Mosque, which is just nearby here in the mid-levels. And we have two other mosques in Chai Wan and also in Stanley Prison. Then we have the Kowloon Mosque, which is probably the most famous and most notable mosque in Hong Kong, in Tsim Sha Tsui, just off Nathan Road. So those are the basic facts about Islam in Hong Kong. Those are the basic types of information that you'll need to begin with. And what I really want to talk about today is to give you an overview of Muslims in Hong Kong in 2013. What is the status of Muslims in Hong Kong at the moment? My research began, my interest began in 1999 when I first came to Hong Kong. And I was doing research at the same time for my master's degree, looking at British Muslims making the pilgrimage to Mecca at that point. And visiting Hong Kong, I was fascinated to find the Islamic community here and very interested to see the experiences of Muslims here in comparison with Muslims in the UK. So there is a particular issue with Muslims in the West and some of the challenges that they have had practicing their religion and being political and religious minorities in the West, that I was interested to see how that played out in the Hong Kong environment. Were Muslims in Hong Kong as free? Did they experience religious prejudice? What kind of issues could we observe? So I'm going to talk a little bit about that today, but to begin with, I want to give you an overview of the history of Islam in Hong Kong, which is essential to really begin with. Really, people are very interested to know when Muslims first arrived, what was the first Islamic community in Hong Kong. We know that Muslims really first established themselves in Guangzhou in the 8th and 9th century when traders from the Middle East and from India came and did business with the local Chinese there. And eventually these Muslims, many settled and became what we now regard as the Chinese Muslims, the Wei people. Now, there is no real evidence to suggest that there was an Islamic community in Hong Kong prior to the arrival of the British, but it is quite possible that Muslims came and traded and may have stayed for a short period of time in the territory. So the history of Islam really begins in Hong Kong with the arrival of the British. And Muslims arrived at that point as soldiers and as sailors and as merchants, connected very much with the British colonial enterprise. And these people set up the very foundations for the Islamic community that still exists today. So to give you some context to that, when we look at the history of the mosques in Hong Kong, land was given in the 1850s for the first mosque here, the Shelley Street Mosque, and in the 1870s for the Islamic Cemetery in Happy Valley. And that set up the very beginning of Islam in Hong Kong, the institutions that were set up at that point. And Muslims contributed to society at that point as well. So referring back to the layout of mosques in the territory, where I mentioned that four of the mosques actually are on Hong Kong Island, this actually shows you the importance that Muslims had in the colonial administration as part of the actual structure of Hong Kong, the fact that those mosques were there in the central aspect and the importance of Muslims to those particular jobs. Again, the Kowloon Mosque originated when there was a need to provide for the Punjab regiment that was stationed at Whitfield Barracks just off Nathan Road. So that's the origins of Hong Kong's Islamic population, the culture of Islam in Hong Kong, and there's a very different environment today. There's much more to say about the history of Islam in Hong Kong, but today I really want to talk about the contemporary issues. So one of the key things that I found in my research was the experience of Muslims, because I focused initially on young Muslims in Hong Kong. That's where the bulk of my research took place. I wanted to find out the experiences of young Muslims in Hong Kong, growing up, being born in Hong Kong, being educated in Hong Kong, as they were a key source of information in terms of how they actually perceived Hong Kong to be in terms of the attitude towards Muslims, and also they had a greater idea of Hong Kong culture and Chinese culture. One of my key findings was the experience of freedom in comparison with racism and prejudice. So first of all, I want to talk about freedom. Recently in the news last week, there was a report that actually listed Hong Kong as one of the top free places in the world by the Fraser Institute. Now, there are many criticisms of that report in itself, and it talked an awful lot about economic freedom, but what we have from the Muslim point of view, especially young Muslims, they recounted a great deal that they were free to practice their religion. They had freedom to be a Muslim in Hong Kong. And they also had freedom in the way that they practiced their religion, which was key to a lot of people. And this was often portrayed to me in contrast with the experiences that they might have maybe back home in Pakistan. Some people who had arrived in Hong Kong and characterized the difference between being a Muslim in Hong Kong and in Pakistan. And others contrasted it with the experiences of their cousins or their aunts and uncles back in the UK, where they felt that even though there was freedom in the UK, for example, there was a lot more violence and intimidation in terms of being a Muslim and racism that they didn't experience in Hong Kong. So on top of this, there was the issue, again and again, everyone I spoke to brought up the issue of freedom, and this is why it's one of the first things that I want to mention to you. And it was portrayed in the way that there was physical freedom, that actual safety, political freedom, that you could believe what you want, you could dress how you wanted to. Something that wasn't actually true, for example, in Pakistan or, for example, in the UK, where people are experiencing prejudice if they have the dupatta on, for example. And one guy in Chungking Mansions actually described to me that it was a psychic freedom, that he was mentally at ease in Hong Kong, that he felt safe and comfortable. But of course, one of the issues that people really want to talk about when we look at Islam in Hong Kong is the issue of racism and prejudice. And this is a very real issue. As many of Hong Kong's Muslims are ethnic minorities, in as much as different to the Chinese Muslims, for example, where Chinese Muslims are basically invisible in Hong Kong, Pakistani, African, Indonesians experience different levels of racism. One of the surprising things I found was that even though this racism is very real and it's an aspect of everyday life that can really influence your life experiences and your opportunities, many of the young Muslims in Hong Kong actually tried to dismiss it in many respects, saying that it was part of Hong Kong culture, that in Hong Kong, racism is part of everyday life. And they characterized that also as the fact that they were free. So it didn't matter if people were racist because basically they were free to do as they pleased. Now I want to emphasize that this is really the experiences of young Muslims, and they still, in many cases in school, they had yet to realize or yet to experience in many cases how racism was actually going to limit and curtail their actual freedoms and opportunities when they finally left school. So in talking about that, one of the issues I also like to talk about is education. And this is a key issue that really I've become quite an advocate of from doing my research. Muslims learn to be Muslim in Hong Kong by a variety of different ways. They learn at home from their parents. They also learn in the mosque to read the Quran. And they also learn, in some cases, at school. There are some Islamic kindergartens, and there is one Islamic secondary school in Hong Kong as well. But in many cases, that is all the opportunity that they get to learn about Islam. But the other side of education that is really important for Muslims that I came to understand is the fact that so many young Muslims were really keen and interested to learn Chinese and to actually have an opportunity to contribute and be part of Hong Kong society. And whilst a number of Muslims could actually speak fluent Cantonese, and they spent many time with Hong Kong friends who were Hong Kong Chinese, also spoke Cantonese, they actually were at a disadvantage because at school they seldom got the opportunity to actually learn Chinese and to take a really serious shot at taking exams in Chinese to actually become proficient in Chinese. And this is one of the issues that I think is really key when we look at not just Muslims but ethnic minorities in Hong Kong in the present day. In addition to this, another one of the issues that came up again and again, in contrast to the issues of freedom and prejudice, was the issue of halal food. And halal food is really important for Muslims in Hong Kong, and I'm trying to give you a bit more information about why it is so important. If we think about the prohibition against pork in particular in Islamic culture, when we think of Islamic countries, pork isn't something that's available, isn't available in Islamic countries. And I remember seeing this online at one point. There was a forum, and one expat in Saudi Arabia was trying to get hold of bacon for a bacon sandwich. And he was asking people, is there anywhere that I can get hold of bacon in Saudi Arabia? And someone replied on the forum. He said, if you want to get pork in an Islamic country, go to the Chinese embassy. So that highlights the passion that Chinese people have for pork. And to emphasize this a little bit more, if we look at the actual the Chinese character for home, you see that it contains the character for roof and also the character for pig. So that shows you how important pork is in Chinese culture. So the issue for Muslims in Hong Kong is basically how to preserve a halal diet in a Chinese food cultural environment, where so many of the foods that are available and accessible actually have traces of pork in them. And I'm talking specifically about pork rather than the other issues of halal food that, you know, include ritual slaughter. Pork is such a big issue in Hong Kong that it basically permeates a lot of the ambiguity that Muslims have regarding their daily life in Hong Kong and how they move around. I've got a various selection of pictures here. I'm not going to zoom in on them all, but what I wanted to talk about here is the lack of clarity that Muslims experience. Particularly for young people, I found that, again, some of the issues with education meant that they had to travel a long way to go to school. They might not necessarily go to a school that is near their home. And if they're away from home for a while, they're traveling, they're on the street doing different things, they often want to pick up a snack. So sumai at 7-Eleven is a classic snack that a lot of kids like, whether they're Chinese or they're Pakistani or they're Indonesian or Filipino. People love this snack, myself included. And one of the issues with sumai is that people, Muslims, believe that it's okay because it's fish. Muslims are allowed to eat fish. However, one Chinese Muslim I have spoken to, she was unsure about how well you could trust sumai, and she took some to a laboratory, had it tested, and it had pork oil included in it. And this is the feelings of many Muslims in Hong Kong, that you cannot trust any Chinese food because it can always have pork in it. And it's always a very dangerous and ambiguous thing to get involved in. So a lot of Muslims don't really eat Chinese food. I had one guy that told me he just didn't go anywhere near, not even a bowl of rice. And so this is a really big issue. And I think that when people talk about complaints that Muslims might have in Hong Kong, this is one that sometimes doesn't get the attention that it should do. And another picture down here at the bottom, there is a takeaway that has a halal certificate. And you can see that it also has, I can actually zoom in on this, also has next to the halal certificate, bottles of beer on the side of it. And of course, for many Muslims, this is completely unacceptable. Okay, so that's the issue of halal food. Before I really conclude, I want to also talk about Indonesians in Hong Kong, because they are a relatively new community, and they have really altered the face of Islam in Hong Kong. If you travel around the territory, if you particularly come to Causeway Bay on a Sunday, you'll see that it is transformed into an Indonesian space. And Indonesians in Hong Kong, the issue of halal food is one area where it's really key for Indonesians, because every person I spoke to during my research, everyone shunned pork. No one would eat pork, and the issue of halal food was really key. But because of the vulnerability of many Indonesian foreign domestic workers in Hong Kong, because of their economic fragility, the fact that they have to repay debts, they often find themselves in situations where they're willing to appease their employers, and they actually eat pork in order to sustain their employment. And this is a real issue, and it's the only group of Muslims in Hong Kong that I found that were honest to say that they did this and actually found that it was something that was a real problem for them. So to give you a quick overview of Indonesians in Hong Kong, they are a new community, and they've come in great numbers following the SARS crisis of 2003. The majority, they are female. And if we actually look back at the history of Islam in Hong Kong, this is a great contrast to the original Muslims that arrived, who were generally all male, soldiers, prison officers, police guards. Now we have the majority of Muslims in Hong Kong being female. They are prone to exploitation because of the nature of the way that they train before they come to Hong Kong. They are vulnerable to exploitation, and they have to repay the debt of their training when they arrive in Hong Kong. So one of my respondents spoke to me, and she said that for 7 months while she was living in Hong Kong, when she first arrived, she was surviving on $50 a month because the rest of her money was being paid back to her training facility. And she was being paid the actual legal limit. Many Indonesians, because they are desperate to have this money to start repaying their debt, are signing contracts that basically they can't read, first of all, but are paying them underneath the legal limit. And in addition to that, they are getting into debt, and they're being exploited, and it's creating a whole host of other social problems as well. Now, to conclude on this and really bring it back to the issue of Muslims in Hong Kong in the present day in 2013, I want to talk about the status of Muslims and what are the key issues right now. I've already spoken about education, and from my perspective, whilst I did a lot of work with young Muslims, I am a very strong advocate of the fact that Muslims in Hong Kong and other ethnic minorities need to be given the opportunity to actually be a part of Hong Kong, to actually follow from their ancestors who originally set up the Islamic institutions and the Islamic culture that exists here, and be important again, and to actually contribute to the society. Whilst Muslims are regarded, whilst ethnic minorities are regarded as foreign citizens, and they are not given the opportunity to learn Chinese in a realistic manner, without any development of a serious curriculum that will actually deal with the needs of ethnic minority pupils, they are going to find their situation will become more and more marginal, and they will become more and more disaffected, which is a really key issue right now. When we look back at 2012 was a really volatile time in Hong Kong in terms of domestic politics. When we look at double negative births, when we look at the parallel trading in Shanghai, there were a lot of frictions between the Hong Kong population and the mainland Chinese. And the issues of ethnic minorities have been overlooked in many respects because of this. And minorities now have been referring more and more to the mainland Chinese and the frictions with them. So as we stand in 2013, these are the issues that are going to be important as we go forward. Also, with regards to the mosques that exist in Hong Kong, many Muslims no longer live on Hong Kong Island. And they no longer live maybe in the nearer areas of Tsim Sha Tsui. They live in the new territories, perhaps in Yuen Long and Tuen Mun. And there is a need for mosques to cater for their daily lives in those areas. This is a key issue that many Muslims will talk about. So I will close now and thank you for your time and open the floor up to questions. Thank you very much.
Yes, please, over here.
Quick question about, thank you. How friendly or how many Muslims are there in the police now compared, say, to 50 years ago? I get the impression that perhaps in deep colonial times, in a way that Muslims were more integrated into institutions like the police.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The important aspect of the history that really I glossed over rather fast is how integral Muslims were, South Asians were really as well, in the colonial administration. They also provided a buffer in many senses between the colonials and the Chinese population. The police was, as you can see, there was the photo up previously of the South Asian police officers. They were recruited for many years, and I think recruitment into the police force from Pakistan, because after the partition, there was a deal with the colonial government to recruit police officers from Pakistan. That ceased, I think, in the early 1960s. And so right up until that point, we had Muslim police officers and also a lot of Pakistani prison guards as well. And gradually they have retired and they've fallen off. But there are still some in the police force, of course, but they don't have anywhere near the significance that they once did. And they were obviously very key and contributed enormously. I mean, the Shroff office that we all are so familiar with in Hong Kong has its origins in the colonial Shroff, which is a hybrid term from Urdu and Arabic. So that has the... Yes, it has that origin. Yes, okay, good. But there have been present-day initiatives to recruit more ethnic minorities into the police force, and that's been in the news quite recently that there have been a couple of high-profile, there's one girl in particular who has come through the police force, whose grandfather, I believe, was either a police officer or a prison warden as well. So there are efforts for the police to actually try and tap that resource, but a lot more needs to be done in terms of education as well before that can really work in the same ways.
I saw another question over there.
I have two very quick questions. First of all, you call your book Islam in Hong Kong, but
yes.
You are talking about Muslims, not Islam.
True. The subtitle being Muslims in Everyday Life.
It should have been, something of the sort. And another one is Orient or Islam or Muslims are inherently incapable of describing themselves correctly. That's what Edward Said says.
Mm-hmm.
I'm paraphrasing. Therefore, Europe or Britain or France in general has to describe them. Now, since you have described Muslims in Hong Kong or Islam in Hong Kong, why your book should not be taken as another book in that series of Orientalist books?
Thank you so much. How great is that to get a question about Said and Orientalism? Thank you. Yes, a very well-broached question. Who am I to make these comments? Indeed. And one of the reasons that I have engaged in this work is because I'm not Muslim, and because in many cases, the story of Islam in Hong Kong from a Muslim's point of view is more about Islam. And I think that that's a story that needs to be broached. At the same time, I have been very curious and sensitive about Orientalism and looked at the issues of this and hybridity. And I think that my book in itself stands as a contribution, but I would be very open and very earnestly interested to have the voices of other Muslims contribute as well. I think that everyone should be involved to talk about these sorts of issues.
I have two questions. The
please.
First one, could you please compare the status of Muslims in Hong Kong with the status of Muslim in mainland China? And my second question is, to what extent is the Chinese government persecution of its Muslim population in the north affecting the status of Muslims in Hong Kong?
Sorry, I didn't get the second question.
To what extent is the Chinese government's persecution of its Muslim population in the north affecting the status of Muslim in Hong Kong?
Okay. Okay, great. I have not really looked at the issue of Muslims in China because that is quite a separate issue to the experience of Muslims in Hong Kong. Even for Chinese Muslims, there is a great deal of difference here between their experience and their subject positions and those sorts of environments. What is interesting from my perspective is how this particular focus, the focus for other scholars who, as well, who have worked on Islam in Hong Kong, how that actually contrasts with work on Chinese Muslims in China and the Uyghur population and other minority groups. And they are very different. And it's one of the things I'd like to do more, and one of the things I'm planning to do, actually, is to try and trace some parallels between the two groups. With regards to the persecution of the Uyghurs in the north, there's various opinions about that in terms of the local population, and I think you'd best to talk to some Muslims about how they feel about that. In terms of how it actually affects the politics and the everyday life of Muslims in the territory, it doesn't. It's not something that is of direct relevance at all. It's an entirely separate issue. But the actual feelings towards those groups, yeah, please talk to some Muslims and get their opinions.
Thank you. You had mentioned speaking with a Muslim in the Chungking Mansions. And I was wondering to what extent that's a space that's been claimed by Muslims in Hong Kong, and whether you've done any theorizing about the social value of that space for the Muslim community of the Chungking Mansions.
Okay, Chungking Mansions is a great topic in itself, and I guess many of you are familiar with Gordon Matthews' book on Chungking Mansions, where he really explores this. And one of the things that Gordon mentions that I will also confirm is that Chungking Mansions is a place in Hong Kong, but it's not of Hong Kong. So I've spent a great deal of time at Chungking Mansions. I still do, actually. But one of the things that you can feel about Chungking Mansions is that the Islamic community there, the culture of Islam there, is very specific, and it's not, you can't totally trace that with the experiences of Muslims in Hong Kong. It's a different environment. It's a microcosm all of itself. And that's why, that's one of the reasons I didn't focus specifically on Chungking Mansions. I looked a lot more at the experiences of young people, people who had that balance between Islam and, you know, the Islamic culture, and also the Chinese, Hong Kong Chinese culture as well. But yeah, I do talk about Chungking Mansions in one chapter, so.
Thanks very much.
Hi, hello again.
Yeah, a lot of the history and indeed the present of Muslims in Hong Kong is sort of coming non-indigenous, as it were, people coming from overseas. I just wondered if you could talk a little bit more about the local indigenous Cantonese, or Chinese at least, experience of Islam, those who become Muslims, how they perhaps feel or don't feel a minority because of their religion rather than because of ethnic reasons, and if they experience difficulties because of that?
In my research, when I spoke with Chinese Muslims, and by that I mean Hui Muslims, there was a very different experience and a different presentation than talking to South Asian or Pakistani or Indonesian Muslims. And one particular informant I had was able to really play a double life in Hong Kong, in which she kept the fact that she was Muslim a private issue. So amongst her work colleagues, she didn't reveal the fact that she was Muslim. While she was at school, she didn't reveal the fact that she was Muslim, and she went to a Christian school. And then when she went to the mosque, that was her Islamic space, that was her Islamic time. And this was so much to the extent that she actually, as part of her beliefs, as part of her system of beliefs, she would refrain from watching television. but she would go online and read the synopsises of shows so she could join in with conversations with her friends. So she felt that that was her way of balancing her Islamic culture and her Chinese culture. But her experience was that whenever she put on her hijab and she traveled on the tram or the bus, people would forget that she was Chinese, and they'd say, "Oh, your Cantonese is so good." And they would think that she was Filipino or Indonesian. So she had that experience, and I think that it's probably quite fair to say that many Chinese Muslims are able to play that double role. They don't have the explicit issue of being an ethnic minority, and so they can also choose to be more particular with how they actually follow Islam. And in many cases, because I looked a lot at youth, for Chinese Muslim youth, there was no priority for them to really get involved in Islam in the majority of cases, all the cases. But often parents would say, you know, concentrate on your work, concentrate on your studies. Islam is for religion is something for later in life. So that's one of the patterns that I found.
We're getting close to 2 o'clock, so if there's... Sorry, could I have the gentleman here in front? Yes, thank you.
Oh, sorry, this is a very simple question, very quick, I hope. What's the software you're using for your display? It doesn't look like PowerPoint. I'd love to know.
It's Prezi. Go prezi.com, and okay, you can do these online presentations.
Thank you. Very brief question. To what extent in your observations have you seen any kind of penetration by the Muslims in the various political circles in Hong Kong and business circles as well, like either at the broader Hong Kong level or at the district level, for instance? Is there any movement in that regard?
So you're talking about their actual presence in politics.
Yeah.
Well, there are a number of notable Muslims who are involved in business, that are involved in politics, that are high up in government administration as well. But in terms of how much they can actually make a space for Islam and the needs of the Muslim community, it seems to be rather limited. And this is one of the points that I tried to draw out in conclusion, is that when we look at the issues in the newspaper today, the issues that Hong Kong people are really focusing on, what's really bothering them, pollution, high inflation, you know, their feelings of animosity towards mainlanders and how everything is getting taken away from them, those issues, they don't really correlate and contrast with the issues of the Muslim community, who are regarded as having a much less important voice at the moment. These aren't the key issues. So whilst Hong Kong people are feeling really quite squashed and upset about a lot of issues, I think that minority politics is one of the things that is going to suffer, and it's not really going to get a good airing, and I think that's a shame. Yeah, well, it certainly, in some cases, you can see that in Kowloon and TST to a limited effect, but you can also see that in Chun Mun, but that needs to be further developed. As yet, I don't think that there's a really strong pattern.
Okay, gentleman over there.
Thank you very much for giving us the very good presentation. Some explanation I would like to tell about one thing that you have shown the picture of the colonial rule that some people, they are not the Muslim, actually they are the Sikh with beard and with the turban. And I have seen carefully, I didn't notice that is there any Muslim in this picture. So this should be clarified. And the second, the halal certification, because we issue the halal certificate. As you have mentioned here, we, the Muslim, are facing for having the halal food. So there are two types of certificate. One is the certificate is given to the restaurant that it is serving halal food. And other is the halal certificate is only for the food, not for the whole restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
So because here, a lot of Muslim, when they visit different places, they don't find. So to facilitate them, so we have given the certificate for some restaurant, they are serving only halal food. So the whole restaurant is not halal. So the certificate is only for the food. The third, Chungking mentioned, there are about 15 to 20% Muslims. They are actually the South Asian, like Indian, like some other Nepalese. So they may, the, some people say they are all Muslim. So they are not all Muslim. So in Chungking, the collective culture, what you have observed with other people, so it is not only because of the Muslim. There are some other players who are playing in Chungking Mansion. So these are some observation. Thank you very much. And about the police officers at this time, about two officers are serving in the police, whereas as compared to the colonial rule, there were many police officers, and there were one colony in Shungshui. And the police has given the mosque, still it exists, and we have a weekly gathering and annual the Ramzan functions there. And also there are few, only 5 to 8 people who are working in CSD, Correctional Services Department. Mm-hmm. But recently, as you have mentioned, only one girl has been inducted. Indeed, there is a need for integration if the government would take some more people. So thank you very much for the presentation.
Thank you. And Mr. Arshad, yes. from my research, I know that there were historically a lot of Sikhs and Muslims employed in the colonial police force. And I believe that they had that generic uniform with the turbans, regardless of whether they were Sikh or Muslim.
No, a couple of them had.
Really? Okay. That is something that I then, thank you for correcting me. Okay. Okay.
Sikh, these the turban is used only by Sikh.
But I thought that was part of the colonial.
No, Sikh, the turban is very specific. All turbans are not Sikh turbans.
Okay.
Actually, the Muslims are not supposed to wear all the time the turban. Definitely in the past, many Muslims, they used to wear the turban. But the Sikh, for the Sikh, it is part of their religion. So they have to wear, the government has given the permission to them to wear the turban while they are riding this motorcycle, they are serving the police. But for the Muslim, it is not the case. Like, it is not obligation for us to wear the turban.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for your comments.
I think we're just about at the end of our presentation. So thank you very much. Thank you very much, Paul.
Thank you. Thanks, everybody. Thank you.
And as it is customary, a little gift for our presenter.
Thank you.
Thank you.